It's Thursday, January 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, a British judge says Russia's president was responsible for the killing of a former KGB spy in London.
The report says that President Vladimir Putin probably approved the assassination of Litvinenko, which happened in 2006.
Germany tries to come to terms with the New Year's Eve violence against women in Cologne, and two rock legends prepare to embark on tour. It's all ahead. A British judge on Thursday said that Russian President Vladimir Putin probably approved a plan to poison ex-KGB agent Alexander Litvinenko. I'm joined now by VOA London correspondent Luis Ramirez. So, Luis, in this the ruling, the judge indicated that the Russian president was very likely highly involved in this.
Yes, the report says that President Vladimir Putin probably approved the assassination of Litvinenko, which happened in 2006. When he met with two Russian agents at a hotel in central London. The allegation, which is now conclusive, is pretty much proven by British investigators, was that they laced his tea with a highly toxic radioactive substance known as radioactive polonium. This resulted in contamination of the hotel, and a contamination pretty much spread across the streets of London wherever Mr. Litvinenko was after that moment. He fell ill very quickly, died 23 days later.
And apparently when he was dying, Litvinenko accused Putin of ordering his killing.
You know, we're seeing these photos taken of Litvinenko as he lay dying in his hospital bed, completely emaciated. His hair was gone. He said that he wanted the world to see what Putin had done to him. This assassination comes after a great deal of acrimony because, of course, Litvinenko himself was a Russian spy. He worked for the Federal Security Bureau, which is the agency that took over after the KGB when the Soviet Union was dissolved. And he had a falling out with his agency. There was a great sense of betrayal on either side. But certainly that was made worse when Litvinenko came out and publicly criticized President Putin, including on personal matters. He described him, he described President Putin as a pedophile, which, of course, incensed the Russian leader, who the Kremlin then, of course, denied these allegations. And so that's some of the background leading up to this.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Luis. That's VOA London correspondent Luis Ramirez.
Thank you, Sarah.
I'm joined now by a VOA Moscow correspondent, Daniel Scharf. Daniel, has there been any reaction from Russia, from officials there, to this new report from London?
Yeah, the foreign ministry has made some pretty strong statements calling the Litvinenko case politically motivated, basically saying that this should have been a criminal inquiry and that it has been interfered with by authorities, British authorities, instead of allowing justice to take its course. So fairly strong statement, but not unexpected from the Russian officials. From the beginning, they've been very dismissive of any efforts to have a full inquiry into Litvinenko's death. They've also linked it just in the last 15 minutes or so. Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman has linked it to the situation of fighting in Ukraine, saying that it's probably no coincidence, according to her, that the situation in Ukraine deteriorated just as this public inquiry began, which is a very interesting way of looking at the situation. But it's the way that they've been approaching this from the very beginning has been very dismissive.
Is it known where the location of the two Russian agents that have been blamed for poisoning Litvinenko? Are they within Russia?
Oh, yes, absolutely. They're here in Russia. One of them is actually a parliamentarian. He's been welcomed into the political system here in Russia, And there was also a TV show that one of them was involved in at one point. I'm not sure if that's still on the air. But there's been no attempt by Russian authorities to investigate them in any way. And certainly they've made it clear that they will not be cooperating with the British authorities in extraditing them or investigating them in any way. The charges have been dismissed from the very beginning that they had anything to do with the death of this former Russian spy.
How much coverage has this report concerning the death of Litvinenko been receiving in Russia?
At first, it seemed like they weren't giving it a whole lot of coverage when we first started to see the results of the inquiry breaking today. But then they started to pay much more attention to it. It started to lead some of the broadcasts. And, of course, being challenged on Russian state media, especially the line in the judge's conclusion stating that President Putin probably approved of the alleged assassination. This probably was, of course, challenged by Russian state media. But it is getting some attention today. The entire inquiry has not been given a whole lot of attention. But, of course, when the former spy was originally poisoned and ended up dead, this did get some attention here in Russia. But again, in a very dismissive way, in a way that tried to make it seem like this was some sort of a conspiracy against Russia, an anti-Russian investigation to try and make Russia look bad.
All right. Thanks very much, Daniel. That's VOA Moscow correspondent Daniel Scharf. Well, now for reaction on social media, I'm joined by International Edition's Michael Lippin.
Thank you, Sarah. Well, if you want to find tweets about this story, all you have to do is search for hashtag Litvinenko. You'll see many people expressing a variety of views about this British report, as well as some breaking news. And here's a tweet from Nick Morrison, who's a journalist with the AFP news agency. He quotes British Prime Minister David Cameron, who is in Davos, Switzerland, as saying, "The Litvinenko inquiry confirms what we've always believed, that this was a dreadful murder and a state-sponsored action." Those are words from David Cameron. Another Twitter user by the name of Avenger agrees with Cameron. He says, "The murder of Litvinenko was an act of sickening depravity, and finally those responsible have been exposed for their dreadful act." You also have a variety of other views. A user who goes by the name Je Suis Parisien says, "Litvinenko was an ex-Russian KGB agent who jumped ship to British spy agency MI6. And then he asks, "And you're surprised he was killed?" And then a user by the name of Oliver says, "Some states use polonium-210, while others use drones. Hashtag Litvinenko." And of course, by talking about drones, he's referring to Western powers such as the U.S., which do use drones to kill suspected terrorists around the world. Sarah?
Thanks very much, Michael. That's International Edition's Michael Lippin. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Researchers Konstantin Batygin and Mike Brown at the California Institute of Technology say that they have found evidence of a giant gaseous planet traveling in an odd and drawn-out orbit in the far reaches of the solar system. If confirmed, the newly found planet would be the solar system's ninth planet. Pluto had that honor until it was demoted to dwarf planet status back in 2006. The researchers say this possible new planet, they nicknamed Planet 9, has a mass that's about 10 times greater than Earth's and about 5,000 times that of Pluto. Planet 9 is thought to orbit the Sun from a distance of nearly 20 times further than Neptune, whose average distance from the Sun is about 4.5 billion kilometers. The researchers continue to fine-tune their simulations to find out more about the planet and have begun, along with other researchers, to scan the skies to see if they can get a direct look at Planet 9. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, rock legends Sting and Peter Gabriel plan to tour together. While relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia have been mired in religious and political tensions, analysts argue that the nuclear accord with Iran could add another layer of complexity to the long struggle between the regional heavyweights that may complicate global initiatives like the upcoming talks on Syria's future. International Edition senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shenawy explored that aspect with a couple of experts. Mohammed, let us begin with the history of the Saudi-Iranian feud and how did it develop over recent years?
Well, Iran's Islamic Revolution in 1979 sparked a geopolitical struggle between Iran and Saudi Arabia over their influence in the Middle East. But Wilson Center Middle East fellow David Ottawi says the Arab Spring pushed Saudi Arabia to an unprecedented level of regional activism, which highlighted the sectarian differences between the Sunni-led kingdom and the Shia-dominated government in Iran in some proxy struggles from Yemen to Syria. He says after the signing of the nuclear deal with Iran, Saudis became more determined to roll back Iran's influence in the region,
which was further confirmed in their minds when the United States and Russia invited Iran to the negotiating table regarding the future of Syria. And this has led to a determination on the Saudi part to stand up to Iran, even if the Americans are beginning to try and create a new relationship with Iran that they fear at their expense. And this has just kind of propelled the Saudis into this new, you know, aggressiveness and show of force that they can stand up to the Iranians. And so we're now in the midst of this kind of showdown between the Iranians and the Saudis. And in the midst of this shifting policy by the United States and its relationships towards Iran.
Ottawi noted that the perception of the Saudis was further confirmed when the United States and Russia invited Iran to the negotiating table to discuss the future of Syria. Ottawi fears Saudi Arabia will feel the need to further demonstrate its unilateral capabilities in the region, and analysts say Iran, on the other hand, is trying to show a new openness to diplomacy and cooperation with the West, particularly the United States, pointing to the recent swift release of American sailors held by Iran and a prisoner swap between Iran and the United States.
How did the nuclear agreement with Iran impact the Saudi-Iranian competition for influence in the region?
According to U.S. Institute of Peace fellow Robin Wright, as Iran reemerged onto the global stage, the question of which country is seen as more important to the United States is becoming a focal point for both Saudis and Iranians. Wright fears that the competition could destabilize larger global initiatives like the Syrian peace talks slated to begin next week.
There is a scramble by the United States and its allies to engage in damage control. And one of the constant messages throughout the discussions with both countries is we want to ensure that whatever your difference is, that you are smart about what you do, that we don't see a prolonged crisis as we did in 1988 when the two countries broke relations and it lasted for 3 years, and that most of all, the United States doesn't want to see this split affect the four vital peace processes that are underway.
Wright said the danger is, of course, that even if all sides attend the Syrian peace talks, there is the lack of trust between the two sides that it would be harder to compromise because of the domestic fallout. She recommended that the United States must recognize this reality and check the balance of power between the two to protect the Middle East from the negative impact of the Saudi-Iranian competition.
Thank you, Mohammed, for sharing this analysis.
Thank you for having me.
In other news, Germany is still coming to terms with the New Year's Eve attacks on women in Cologne, allegedly by men of Arab or North African appearance. Cologne police say criminal charges stemming from the crime wave that evening have risen to more than 800, and about 500 of them involve groping and sexual assaults. Recently, six Pakistanis and a Syrian man were attacked in Cologne by gangs, an incident seen as retaliatory. Germany's open-door policy that welcomed more than 1 million refugees and migrants last year is now facing criticism. I spoke with Andreas Roeder, professor of contemporary history at the University of Mainz, which is about 180 kilometers from Cologne. I'm interested in knowing or learning about the impact of the recent New Year's Eve attacks on Germany, and particularly in the area where you are, in the sort of greater Rhineland area. What are the concerns of the public, and particularly of women there?
Germany is a country which does not have much experience with multicultural immigration. So the integration of Turkish guest workers since the 1960s has not been a success story in Germany for decades. So this time, Germans wanted to do better, and so they developed what was called the welcome culture in last year's fall. However, this humanitarian attitude was joined by a certain lopsided naivety. Many people were thinking that the influx of hundreds of thousands of migrants would just solve the German demographic problem. And now, after the Cologne attacks, they are realizing that this influx of migrants is not only a solution for the lack of skilled workers in Germany, but also entails serious problems. As I observe the public mood in Germany, it's pretty much on the brink. And the danger is the German public tends to go from one extreme to the other.
Chancellor Angela Merkel has promoted Germany, particularly, you know, recently, as a place where refugees are welcome. Looking at this for her domestically, is she in political difficulty now with the recent attacks in Cologne and in some other places as well?
The opposition against her politics is massively growing in Germany. So there is, on the one hand, the new right-wing party, the so-called Alternative für Deutschland, a right-wing party which is addressing a nationalist audience on the one hand, but at the same time addressing worried middle classes in Germany, which is the center ground of the Christian Democrats of Angela Merkel's party. So the unrest within her own party is massively rising and pressing Merkel to change her course. However, when she embarked on her course of open borders and refused any limits for the influx of migrants, she was playing at very high stakes. And so I think if she U-turned, this would fundamentally rock her credibility and undermine her position, if she doesn't.
That's Andreas Roeder, professor of contemporary history at the University of Mainz in Germany. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. Two rock and roll icons, Sting and Peter Gabriel, have announced a new North American tour together. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, the Rock, Paper, Scissors tour will have the artists performing not only their own music, but also each other's songs.
Sting, once the frontman for The Police and also a highly successful solo artist, is joining forces with Peter Gabriel, who came to fame with Genesis and has also had a very successful solo career. The Rock, Paper, Scissors tour starts June 21st in Columbus, Ohio. Sting told the Associated Press the idea came after his successful world tour with Paul Simon.
Where we traded songs, we traded musicians, we sang together, and the take-home that people got from that was they loved it when we did things together. So I thought, I'd like to do that again. And who would I do it with? And Peter was one of a very short list of people.
This is not the first time the two artists have toured together. The pair toured on the Amnesty Tour in the 1980s. Peter Gabriel says that experience was one of the best tours ever.
It was, well, we never knew where we were going. We traveled all sorts of amazing countries, great people, but we had all these fantastic musicians traveling together. There were two planes, one carrying the gear and one carrying musicians. Anyway, so that gave us a sense of what it might be, and it was a lot of fun.
Sting and Peter Gabriel are still working out what they want to play and who will do which songs. But Sting says that both artists know the crowd wants to hear the hits.
I mean, we're in those discussions right now and having ideas of, you know, we want to sing a lot of hits, basically. People want to hear us sing the songs we're famous for. But it's always interesting to trade a song, say, you know, take that one. So I'm not precious about giving him whatever he wants.
Peter Gabriel says he is looking forward to having fun with his friend, just like they did in the 1980s.
It's playful, and I think, yeah, we certainly found when we toured together in the past, there was a lot of, in fact, a lot of pillow fights on aeroplanes.
There were pillow fights.
But it was fun. It really was. And there was a lot of great music happening.
And the two artists promise that any disputes on the tour will be settled by the finger-throwing game, which gives it its name, Rock, Paper, Scissors. Though Peter Gabriel says he always waits just a little bit behind his opponent to see what they throw before finalizing his choice. Sting and Peter Gabriel's tour runs through July 25th and ends in Edmonton, Alberta. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
Thank you, David. It sounds like it'll be quite a tour. Well, that is our show for today. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Entering its last year in office, the Obama administration has made it clear that engagement with Asia continues to be a top priority, with an agenda that includes economic, security, and political cooperation with Asian partners. In 2016, the United States will push for approval of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a trade agreement between 12 Pacific Rim countries. The United States will also continue to modernize its alliances and to deepen security relationships with emerging partners. In the Asia-Pacific region, the United States is ready to support its allies in building maritime security, humanitarian disaster relief, and counter-piracy capacity. Maritime security and territorial issues will be clearly on the agenda this year as well, said Deputy National Security Advisor for Strategic Communications Ben Rhodes during a recent speech at the Washington Foreign Press Center. The United States is committed to upholding freedom of navigation, he said. On issues like the South China Sea disputes, we'd like to encourage all parties to de-escalate tensions and resolve their issues through international law. The United States will also continue to cooperate with China on issues of common interest. So, for example, last year, one of the biggest issues that we focused on domestically and internationally was climate change, said Mr. Rhodes.
We would not have achieved the Paris Agreement without the cooperation that the United States and China had on that issue, both in terms of the announcement made in Beijing during his last trip and the subsequent cooperation leading into Paris.
We are going to work very closely with China on a whole range of issues related to the Asia-Pacific, said Mr. Rhodes. For example, we'll be working with China through the UN Security Council and also in our own bilateral discussions about how to demonstrate to North Korea that its recent nuclear test and the threat it poses to our allies and to the world will lead to greater costs, consequences, and isolation.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.